This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Johnny's in the basement mixing up the medicine. Those opening lines from Subterranean Homesick Blues evoke a homemade science laboratory where ingredients known and unknown are being combined in ways that may or not be orthodoxed or officially approved. Perhaps this is why the Bob Dylan Center and curators and authors Mark Davidson and Parker Fischel chose the title Mixin' Up the Medicine to name the first official book from the Bob Dylan Center and the Bob Dylan Archives. As you'll hear in today's conversation, these two have been in the laboratory, choosing between and mixing together all kinds of things, known and unknown, into something very rare indeed, a Bob Dylan book that's unlike all the rest. The magic, of course, is the Dylan Archives. Mark and Parker were working from the inside, with a collection that started from 100,000 items that Bob Dylan and his office saved over the past 60 years, and which has grown rather significantly since the first batch arrived in Tulsa, through massive donations from top Dylan collectors around the world and acquisitions they've made on the open market. Mark is the Senior Director of Archives and Exhibitions for both the Bob Dylan Center and the Woody Guthrie Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And Parker is an archivist who served as the co-creator of the inaugural exhibitions at the Bob Dylan Center. Mark has a PhD in musicology, and Parker has done archival consulting and production work for Thurnband Records, Sony, and others. And not only are they trained and experienced professionals, as you'll hear today, they're huge deep-dive Bob Dylan fans, which shows through in the care and detail and the passion that just drips from every page of this book, as it does from every inch of the Bob Dylan Center. If you haven't yet heard our episode on the Bob Dylan Center, the magnificent Bob Dylan Center, please check out Season 2, Episode 7. I talked with Center Director Steve Jenkins on an interview I did while visiting there on the occasion of their first anniversary. There's a link in the show notes. I love this book, as you're going to hear in this interview. You'll learn a ton more about it in this talk, and because I knew our partner over at Pod Dylan was also interviewing Mark and Parker, I tried to ensure there wasn't too much overlap by focusing on my favorite specific items in the book and taking advantage of the opportunity to ask about what else we all may see from the archives in the future. So enjoy this episode, but you'll also want to check out the Pod Dylan show for a different take and talk about this new book. I'll include a link in the show notes. Also there, you can find a link to our Substack and blog, where we've got a full review of the book, more photos, and a video tour. Now, here's our conversation with Mark Davison and Parker Fischel, authors of Mixin' Up the Medicine from the Bob Dylan Center and Archives. Welcome to Mark Davison and Parker Fischel from the Bob Dylan Center, who have put together the primary authors and curators and creators of this amazing new book, Mixin' Up the Medicine. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Craig.
I was able to see you guys last week out in Bridgehampton and, more importantly, paw through the book quite a few times. Anyway, you know, I think this book is just unbelievable. And I know from talking to Mark in the past and from reading about it that this is a many years in development work. And I really feel like you've given everyone a take-home version of the archive, which is kind of more than any of us could have ever hoped for. What I'd like to start on today is talking about the archive itself, because I know, Mark, you've been there essentially from the beginning, and Parker, I know you've got a couple of years in, and I'm curious as to how you guys think about the archive now and how that's evolved, essentially getting your head around what's there and understanding what it is and how you approach it. You had that archive and you had X amount of pages to fit it in. How did you think about the archive you had, and what was the goal in translating it or some of it or elements of it into this book?
The archive is daunting. It's enormous. For the 60 plus years still going of, creative work that Bob Dylan has created and is creating, it's an enormous amount of paper trail, tape trail, film trail, video trail, just about everything trail that he has left behind that will literally, we'll all still be sifting through it and making the connections, long after we're all gone, probably. It's that rich, that dense, and it reflects, such an enormous, obviously, an impulse to create, a serious work ethic, judicious self-editing, all those things. And so it's a lot to wrap one's head around, and you just kind of have to start in one place and do your best. And so in the creation of this book, we had a good template in that we had just sort of finished the center. So we were able to leverage a lot of the work that had gone into that to sort of have a core to work around. And we also had the benefit where Michael Chaikin, the former curator of the Bob Dylan Archive, and his colleague Robert Polito, poet and professor at the New School in New York City, had commissioned all of these wonderful essays that sort of are sprinkled throughout the book. So we had sort of two building blocks. I said the material from the center kind of provided a core, and we had a lot left over that we couldn't fit into the center, as I know you've been there, but for others who haven't, it's chock full. Hopefully if you go there, you find the same sort of tangled web of connections and make your way through it in sort of a similar way. But so we had that. We had a lot left over. We also had this in the Bob Dylan Center. There's an archive wall, which is sort of the approach that we took to the book, which is that there are objects that allow you to dive into episodes or concepts or themes that are either unique to one sort of part of Dylan's career, like a historical event, or that go across several eras or his entire career. And so that was sort of another building block. So anyway, we had all this at our hand, and we just kind of went through all of the, every single sheet of paper, every single photo several times, and pulled big, enormous buckets of things that interested us. And, the more we went back, the more, especially with that intensive eye to kind of crafting these vignettes, the more we saw how things fit together. We discovered, we're able to say, oh my goodness, this is this, or this relates to that in really sort of surprising and compelling ways. And so that's what I mean when I say that people will be poring over this and finding new discoveries far into the future. And this is just, I think, a starting point.
Was there any sense of this is a representation of the archive versus, you use the, I think the nine sections, I believe it's Sean Mullins came up with those nine time frames that are used in the Columbia Gallery. And that's, I believe, let's mirror the structure of the breakdown of the book.
The nine eras that we have downstairs at the Dylan Center in the Columbia Records Gallery, those were fought over a lot by a number of us to come up with what are good ways to digest a career that, dates back to the early 60s, earlier, in a way that somebody who didn't know very much about Dylan at all could get a sense of what was going on. Where do I start? How do I digest this? We took that approach for the book with some tweaks. I think our years shifted a little bit, our thinking shifted a little bit, and it was partially due to new conversations that we had been having, but also because of the stories that the book told in a certain way that we, as Parker said, we were digging through and finding all these connections and just thought, well, this is the way this has to be. The other factor in all that is, Parker had mentioned, the archive arrived in Tulsa in 2016, and Michael Chaikin and Robert Polito soon thereafter started bringing people to Tulsa to take a look at it and dig through and find something that was of interest to them. And then they, you know, asked them to write an essay about it. And those essays really became the sort of the core of the book that we had initially been thinking about. So part of our way of dividing up the book was also chronologically, you know, these essays definitely will fit here, even if they're not, you know, talking about 1965 or 66. That was also a consideration. So we were working on a few different levels there.
The essays, I got to say, are just fantastic. So many of them really are revealing and interesting, either uncoveries or new ways of thinking about something. You know, we've all read 100 Dylan books, and a lot of these, even the episodes, have been gone over in various ways. But, you know, sometimes because of the archive material, sometimes the essayist is really talking about what they saw and telling us things that either they didn't know before and or, you know, at least we didn't know before. And in some cases, just who they were and the kind of thinking and writing they could bring to it. But they really are not superfluous. And so I'm not at all surprised to hear you say to some degree they're structurally part of the way you thought about the framing the whole book, because they're really amazing. I made it about halfway through in detail, where I feel like I've really read every word and every essay. And I can't wait to get to the rest. I'm very interested to go back, Mark, and see the shifts you made in the 9 designations.
I would just say one additional guiding concept, something we took from the center, the multiplicity of voices. So like we all, like you said, have read a million Dylan books, and we felt like Dylan's story is best told almost like the Todd Haynes, right? Through like all these different voices. And so the essays contribute that. Mark and I wrote these long captions that sort of illuminate each episode and set of images, but also we drew in as much as possible from the raw interviews that were done from No Direction Home, which are part of the Bob Dylan archive. The Bob Dylan Center has been doing these wonderful interviews with various people who have direct and not so direct connections to Dylan. And so we pulled from those as well. I think they all help showcase different dimensions that point out things that any one person wouldn't be able to see, right? Griffin Adache sees all these things because of what he brings to the table that I would have, you know, no basis in because I haven't read Conrad's Victory. So yeah, I think that's a really important way about also how we approached the book.
I was thinking this morning that all of Dylan's work, you know, we've all learned it takes years sometimes to digest it, or at least you'll have a very different view of it 10 or 20 or 40 years after the fact. But sometimes, especially now with the archives and the bootleg series and all the reissues, things come at us, and as well as the new things, so fast that it's hard to give them the time, each one, the time, you know, that it needs. And Philosophy of Modern Song was one that I spent a fair amount of time on and could imagine, you know, hundreds more hours in terms of conversations and things that are in there, and just to stop and think about it. And your book is, I think, the biggest of them all. It's kind of a fun book. You can leaf through it. You know, it's very immediate gratification because there's so many killer visuals and nothing's thick and heavy. And even the essays at most seem like they're 4 pages. You know, maybe there's one or two that go a little bit longer. So you can kind of dip in and out and so forth. But the depth, or the opportunity for depth there, and focusing on kind of every little thing is really, you know, as good. I made a list. You were talking about the parts that are there, and I was trying to understand it. And there's the photos, and there are so many killer photos that my notes are like bullet, bullet, bullet of the things I thought were new or exceptional. And I just have this photo name, wow, photo name, wow. And I wound up with this, I couldn't believe how long it was getting, of these incredible photos that I had not seen. So there's the photos, there's the memorabilia, fun stuff, record covers, posters, that kind of thing. The manuscripts, the lyrics, which is another incredible dive. And it occurred to me today that Dylan's writing is like perfect Dylan, which is, you kind of can't make it out. So it seems like a blur, you know, like listening to a song in the background. But if you go in super focus, it's, you know, every line, or often there's just these holy cow things in there. Then there's the essays, then there's your text, and then there's kind of the event structure that you built it around. And that really is a lot of things coming at a user. And they don't feel it, but I'm saying it's this multiplicity of things going on that are really worth exploring. So just hats off to you guys for figuring out how to architect and shoehorn in so much, you know, so many great things. Well, let's talk about, well, let's go into a little bit. So I did start making this list of my favorite things. I thought that would be a fun way to go through this, the stuff that kind of surprised me in the book. Well, here's one. The Johnny Cash letter about Train of Love. And you got a couple pages about the Johnny Cash relationship. And that there's a letter that Johnny wrote to Bob after the performance that we've all seen of Bob doing Train of Love in the 99, I think, at the Hammerstein Ballroom. Anything else about the Cash relationship or that little vignette that you guys want to share more on?
Yeah, I love that section too. I love it because for a number of reasons, mostly because what a warm sort of relationship that they seem to have had from what we have available to us. And I knew as I was reading through the letter that's on the opening spread that talks about Mother Maybelle loving Restless Farewell, that like that was the one I wanted to use because like how cool is that, right? And I loved the way in which prior to anybody having these access to these letters that Johnny was writing to Bob. And so you can kind of glean what was going back and forth that like the story they told lined up, right? They were writing these letters and then they finally get to meet. And it's this like ecstatic moment. So I thought, you know, that's a really amazing thing as well. And then, yeah, when I was just talking about like how people will continue to find things in the archive forever. So it was like pretty deep into the book. We had that scrap of paper that Johnny Cash scribbled his address on. That was part of the scraps of paper found in Dylan's wallet that had come to the archive that's on display in the center that also had Otis Redding's business card. And it had contact information for the poet Adrian Rawlings and Bjorn, the photographer Bjorn Larsson Ask, and what's her name? Annette Kullenberg from ID Magazine. So you could kind of date it to about 1966, right? And then that's Johnny Cash scribbled down address was part of that. So we could kind of associate it, but then I looked for that address and it's like, oh yeah, he lived there. That's the address where he lived with Waylon Jennings for like 1 year. When you think about that, it adds a whole other dimension to this little, you know, quickly scrawled address on a, you know, strip of paper that got thrown into a wallet, which got thrown into, you know, presumably a box and sat around until it ended up at the Bob Dylan Center. And so I think that's like the level of details that people will continue to sort of pull from the archive that will make the enrich the whole story for years to come.
That whole thread of, I mean, there's a lot of Bob's work and a lot of his professional life and all kinds of incidents we know about that obviously take up a lot of the book, but these little bits of behind the curtain, you know, private life and the unfinished letters are part of it. Both directions I think are great, but these little things where you kind of say, oh, that's just something that Bob was doing or was happening to Bob or someone said to him. It's really an interesting, incredible insight that we really rarely have obviously ever gotten before. So it really adds a shape to this. I'll ask you about two other letters that are, I think, close after the Johnny one. One is the Paul Williams letter. I'm so happy you have the essay about Paul. I'm a huge Paul Williams fan, as a lot of hardcore folks are. And it's just beautiful that Clinton wrote that and that you included it in the book. But shocking that there's, and I'll let you tell about it, a piece of a letter Bob was writing to Paul that was apparently never sent.
Yeah. No, Clinton's essay about that is incredible and really fitting that he's the one to take that on. Yeah, that is one of only a couple of letters that we have unsent in the archive, partially because just not a lot of letters from Dylan to others just exist. The archive has a lot of letters to Bob from various people from, you know, across the years, but just not a lot exist going out. So that's pretty incredible. And the letter to Allen Ginsberg as well that we've got in there is another one of those unsent letters that from around that same time period that are pretty fantastic.
I just wanted to point out that the reason they were never sent is because they were never finished. Those are, you know, they're like, they trail off and he's moving on to the next thought. Right. So there's a reason that, you know, they stuck around.
Yeah. And there's a great letter from Ginsberg back to Dylan. I think it's 69. He asked Bob what his best verse was. And he came back and says, to live outside the law, you must be honest. And this other quip about Dylan saying, Ginsberg and some of his poet friends had looked hard at Dylan's work and assessed that one out of every four lines was great.
Yeah.
And Dylan said he was trying to up his quota, his percentage.
Yeah, that's from the No Direction Home interview with Ginsberg. And there's so much rich detail. I mean, I love the detail that we pulled out about how, you know, Kerouac was a fan. I don't think I'd ever heard that before, though I'm sure, you know, people who are maybe, it's something that Ginsberg may have said multiple times. But also, I never knew the detail that Ginsberg had, you know, tried to get William Burroughs on as part of the Rolling Thunder review. I think that's, you know, another sort of one of those details that's like, wow, you know, what would that have been like? What role would William Burroughs have found himself in, you know, in that situation? And
a fan, a hardcore fan, can kind of leaf through and go, you know about it, know about it, know about it, because we have seen the incidents. But, you know, the Archibald MacLeish thing, or Ferengetti at City Lights, or George Harrison in Woodstock, are all, those are three I put on a list here. And I know there's many, many more where we knew about it, but you guys come with literally the receipts. You know, there's a letter, there's a photo, there's a detail that wasn't there before. And that the difference is often enormous, because you reveal something. Like, there's that, I don't know whose essay it is about Hazel, or not about Hazel, about Dirge.
Dirge. Yeah, Raymond Foy.
The Dirge essay is unbelievable.
It's a really amazing one.
Yeah, where he uncovered all these things we didn't know, and maybe potential meanings and other references that got left out. It's just so incredibly enlightening. Let's talk about the photos for a minute. The book is full of incredible photos of a guy who we've all seen, a ton of incredible photos. How it would seem that editing and that curation on your guys' part would have been as hard as anything else here, because I know there are just tens of thousands, and you've got a guy who seemingly has been around every good photographer in the world at the right time in his life, and never walks in a room and doesn't get photographed. So there's no, literally no shortage of material, and somehow looks good in every goddamn one of them, which is, you know, good for him, but amazing. Oh, Mark's got some exceptions.
No, I agree. I agree.
Yeah. So anyway, tell me about curating the photos, because it's a huge part of this book, and they're, you know, to wow, you know, I'm just representative, but to wow someone who's leafed through 100 million Dylan pages before. So here's some of my wows. I got the list open here. So the Pat, this is on the memorabilia, Pat Garrett Spanish lobby card. Like, I want a 6-foot poster of that. It's just gorgeous. That there's a photo at the other end. I didn't write down what's in it, but it's great. The full Blood on the Tracks cover photo. I've seen, I knew it was an enlargement of his head, but I'd never seen the full wide frame foot to head. And it's a beautiful photo in and of itself.
Oh yeah.
The World of John Hammond, where you see John Hammond with Bob in the background. I mean, anyway, I could go on all day, but I'm just saying, A, you're going to blow away all the fans with what's in there. Tell me how you curated photos.
One of the first things that I did, that Parker and I did, was to get a bunch, 160 or so binders of photos digitized, and
something like 10,000 images.
It was more than that.
All right, way more.
Yeah, yeah. I remember, you know, getting the files back and just going, oh gosh, this is, we would have to hire a dozen people for, you know, 100 years to go through and just identify people. And so we had a lot to work with. One of the nice things is that with a framework like the one that we had, segments of Dylan's life, stories we wanted to tell, that sort of, it allowed us to winnow down pretty quickly. There were instances, no doubt, where the photos, you know, were the reason for the season, and they sort of, from the photo came the story. I'm certain, Parker, that you have some thoughts on some of the photos you chose.
We tried to, certainly many of these photos will be familiar. You know, there are iconic Dylan images that are iconic for a reason. And those, for someone who is not as well versed in Bob Dylan as the three of us, you know, are something that ground them in the book and give them something to hold on to as they sort of move through. So those are there. and they're great. And I think in this context, it shows like how great they are. But then, if, you know, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, we had access not only to the amazing holdings of the Bob Dylan archive, but I'll say that like Sony Music has been a great partner in the Bob Dylan Center and in this book project. And they, early on in the archive's existence, provided a set of their photo archive, their Bob Dylan photo archive, to the Bob Dylan archive. And so we had all of those to pour through as well. And so like it runs the gamut from like a beautiful Richard Avedon photo to I was going through the photos from Town Hall that Don Hunstein had taken, and I noticed there's this photo of blurry. So there's no reason anyone would have ever used it, but there's a photo of Bob, you know, Dylan walking off stage with papers in his hand. Presumably at the end of the Town Hall concert, he, for the first and last time, he publicly kind of performs this piece of prose called Last Thoughts on Woody Guthrie. And presumably those are the sheets of paper he has in his hands. And then, you know, the archive has not those sheets, but a later sort of typescript of the speech, but we were able to sort of pair those. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, we didn't, sometimes it's a beautiful image for a beautiful image sake and it carries the weight. And sometimes it's because it connected with objects or other artifacts in the archive and it could, you know, that makes a story come alive. So we tried to hit both ends of the spectrum. And then there's a lot of in between. Another great one is like, you know, there's a W. Eugene Smith photograph of Dylan at Columbia Recording Studios in New York City the day he's recording Like a Rolling Stone, and he's standing next to his then manager Albert Grossman, looking, poring over the back of a copy of The Byrds' Mr. Tambourine Man, in advance of that, you know. And like the W. Eugene Smith, I mean, he's an incredible photographer, you know, and so it felt a little bit gratuitous to sort of use it documentary image, so to speak, of his, but you know, pairing that with the photo of press photo of Dylan at Ciro's in Los Angeles, and the Nobody Sings Dylan Like Dylan, and then, you know, like I said, we had this like big bucket, so we had all kinds of other things that we had to cut in order to like focus in those three and bring it together. But that allowed us to sort of tell the story of Dylan and the Byrds, and sort of how, you know, cover songs remain this sort of vital outlet for his songs in that period and beyond.
There's one other instance in the book, credit goes to Parker on this one, where we found, and there are some instances throughout the archive of this, he found a picture, a photo by Daniel Kramer of those sessions for Like a Rolling Stone. And you see a manuscript flipped over. And because we have the actual manuscript, we know that it's the unfinished song Mavis manuscript. So we were able to tell that story with a scan of the manuscript and the photo of Daniel Kramer. And we were able to talk about Mavis Staples and the Staple Singers. And so, yeah, it's those sorts of things that made the book fun for us.
Yeah. There's another instance where it's Barry, you know, there's D.A. Pennebaker footage in 1966 of Barry Feinstein taking the photo of Dylan in Liverpool with all the kids on the steps. And like, you know, then it's like, okay, here's, you know, a screenshot from Pennebaker's footage. You know, here is the actual photo that Barry took. And like, here's a notebook from the period with, you know, Dylan writing Barry Feinstein in a little notebook. Like, it's just those little things that make it feel, maybe a little more intimate, or, you know, make the story come alive.
The job you do in that, in telling those little vignettes and yet kind of finding the boundaries. So I don't know if I'm the first person to make this observation, but I was looking through and the Hard Rain line of Dylan's came to me, that, you know, every line's a song, but he didn't have enough time. And I felt like every page is a whole book and you guys didn't have the space. You could see so many of those things going further. How did you think about that? In other words, you know, there's a lot of incidents, especially, I mean, again, I've done the first half of the book, maybe up until probably just after the gospel years. But so many of those incidents that you not had to, but out of the constraints of, you know, it's a 600 page book. And it's, as I said in my pre-review, you know, it's fatter than any New York phone book I've ever seen. So, you know, you couldn't necessarily put more in, but you have things like Rolling Thunder or things like the, you know, the civil rights speech, you know, at the time he said stuff he shouldn't have said and so forth, that you could spill over easily to more than one column or more than two pages. And when you were conscious of that, how did you think about it? And how did you have the discipline? Were you guys just crying about, oh, I want this, got to go in, this has got to go in? I mean, it just had to be incredible cuts.
Yeah. I'll admit, as Parker and I were writing this, it was probably Kerouac-esque. We ended up over the course of 10 or 11 weeks writing 10 to 15,000 words a week for a chapter. Not all of that made it into the book. So we're going to have our own archive at some point. And the selection process, at some point, the editing of everything that we had done and going over and back over and back over, polishing, refining, it's said for a reason. I mean, edit yourself mercilessly. And we tried to do that as best we could while being very, very excited about the materials in the archive and stories we wanted to tell. So that was definitely a balance. I mean, it could have been a book the size of what it is now for every single chapter and then some. At some point, we wanted to bring all these, you know, the voices that we talked about together from interviews that the Dylan Center did, No Direction Home, the photos, the images, the manuscripts, the stories, the eras, like all of that, and still make it appealing to what was sort of our driving idea behind the Dylan Center. Olson Kundig, our lead principal design firm, Alan Maskin, who was heading that up for us and helping us shape the Dylan Center, early on said skimmers, swimmers, and divers, people who wanted to skim the surface of, you know, Bob Dylan's life and career. Swimmers, people who wanted to get a little bit deeper. And then those people like yourself who really want to, you know, really, really dive in deep. We attempted to do that with this book as well, sort of as a guiding principle that anybody could pick it up and get something out of it.
It's so hard not to front load Dylan's career in attention because it's so, you know, unparalleled. And yet there's a lot in the last 30 years. So I'm just wondering how you guys thought about that. That was even a consideration. You just said, well, everything gets what it deserves and we keep going and we see how many pages it is at the end.
I think we naturally fell into things being relatively equal. We were largely driven by what was in the archive. That's what this book is really built around. So even like, you know, the question you just asked about the writing, it was like, we're going to set it up for somebody who has no idea. This is what the album is. You know, here's a general synopsis, but here's something that either this lyric manuscript or this photo or whatever, or some other detail that we can pull in that only the archive can kind of tell us, or only the archive can, it's either new or it snaps it into focus or it puts it in a new light, any of those things. And so, you know, I think actually they're all pretty equal other than the last chapter, maybe the first chapter, which deal with Bob's youth in Minnesota and the last, 2013, the last decade, largely because materiality has changed in the past 10 years and so many things are digital. So there aren't, you know, the same sort of sets of album proofs or what have you. Also, you know, the archive itself goes through Tempest. And so, you know, the things of the past, well, actually, it goes through Shadows and Fallen Angels because it has the session tapes for those. But
did Bob's collection, I mean, it's, you know, we're all blown away by the things you have from the 60s, right, in the 70s. Did the stuffing papers in the right pocket or in the right box continue from his side as much in the 80s and early 90s, for example? Or does it seem like you got less?
No, considerably more. You know, I think stuff got saved as time went on. I don't know how it got saved or whatever, but, you know, it did. Like, I think the longest actual chapter is the one that covers 79 to 87. That's actually, yeah, mm-hmm. Because there's each turn feels like it needed a little bit more to sort of set it up and show you how it fit into the sort of longer arc of Dylan's creative life. It was driven by the archive. Like, you know, we've been talking about this as sort of an inside out biography, you know, told through objects in the archive or holdings of the archive.
As I went through kind of trying to find out what haven't I seen, what's new, like you say, you see a mix of things and I've seen that, but then you go, well, wait a minute, what's that one? And it's like, holy cow. One of those ones, back to finds, the 1978 list of new songs. There's a little hotel scrap with 12 or 14 songs on it. That's like, there's nothing better for a Dylan fan than a list of songs we haven't seen before, most of which we haven't. Anything more about that 78 list you can tell us?
We had a lot of fun with the 78 stuff because there's a lot on hotel notepads when we were sifting through sort of the wider set. So you can really, assuming, you know, he wasn't picking up the notepad in the Holiday Inn in this city and bringing it to the next one. And, you know, you can kind of see where things are happening. And, you know, the archive itself has a number of soundboard, you know, cassettes from the 78 tour, including sometimes sound checks where he's working on these new songs. So, you know, they aren't just a name on the paper. If, you know, you're a researcher and you come to the Bob Dylan Center, conceivably you could listen to, you know, early versions of some of these songs, including like, you know, Slow Train from Cut Trouble No More. Those early versions are taken from these cassettes. And so, yeah, Slow Train is one where the initial version of it, of that sort of song, us describing that song, led you through, I guess we still talk about it in the text, but we had all the sort of, you know, hotel stationery with all the early versions from the 78 tour leading down into the, where he's working on the song, presumably in 1979. It's endlessly fascinating.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, think about, you know, he has this whole list of songs and like, you know, I don't remember all of them on there, but I don't think they're all scrapped. And now he's got this, you know, new, you know, vision, a new set of songs he's going to write that are amazing. And like, it's just that, you know, not just the output, but the high level of the output, the knowing when something is a judge of his own work, you know, an astute judge of his own work.
I love the story of the origin of Planet Waves. This, you know, the record company thought an album would be good for the tour. Bob happened to buy a house and have a week and write a bunch of songs. I don't know if that was ever reported before. That was completely new to me and fascinating.
That was like part of a notebook with a lot of Planet Waves material. And it was, it's one of those things like the unfinished letter. He was clearly starting to write something and then decided for whatever reason that, you know, he wasn't going to finish it. But we were able to sort of pluck out that detail. So it comes from Dylan, but, you know, we all know Dylan can like the, you know, play with the story. That's part of what he does and why he's so great. And so, you know, take it for what it's worth.
Let me ask you two other kind of general archives questions. So you guys have shared the restoration work you've done on the Pennebaker film. You've mentioned that the Hard to Handle Australia material got some actual work and attention. How are you thinking about video restorations? Meaning, is it sort of one project at a time and you decide the next one and then go, or are there multiple things going on depending on whether they, the archival value is there that they need it? Again, slightly different from this book, but it's something that obviously the fans really care about, and what you're doing is very important. What more can you tell us about that?
As the stewards of the archive and keeping the stuff alive, conserved, preserved is part of, it's a big part of why we exist. There's a, I don't know if they still use this year, but there was a doomsday year for a lot of archivists for audiovisual materials of 2028, when these, you know, materials would either be unplayable or machines wouldn't exist. You know, these items are, you know, they deteriorate. And there are all kinds of, you know, great fragrance and wonderful ways that they do deteriorate. Vinegar syndrome and sticky shed and loss of binder and all these super awful things that we learned about in school. So yeah, that's part of our charge. In fact, we're, you know, separately working on the preservation and digitization of some Phil Oakes films that are also part of our collection in Tulsa. We have Woody Guthrie, we have Phil Oakes, Bob Dylan, Cynthia Gooding, Tom Paxton, Ron Cohen, some Izzy Young. Yeah, just a lot of collections that we're working with. And you know, I will say that from the moment that the archive came, and even before, you know, Dylan's folks spent a lot of time and care in making sure that everything was digitized, a process, you know, job that we've continued to make sure that this stuff, you know, survives, you know, in perpetuity, or as close to that as we can hope.
So there are there any other sizable video projects that are on the horizon that you can say that, you know, we have this and it needs work and it's somewhere on the list?
The part that I should say is that work that we're doing doesn't translate into it ever seeing the light of day. The work we're doing is just simply, you know, conservation, preservation, digitization, making sure that in 5-10 years, if somebody in any of the Dylan camps wants to make use of it, that the stuff has survived.
But it gives us us out here hope to know it exists and that it's being done.
Yeah, most I can't think of a film I can't think of a film project that you might name that, and even some that are like only in the archive that you'd be able to name and that hasn't been taken care of yet. The film collection is pretty well in hand.
And doing the Australian Petty Dylan stuff was a recent project because there was so much of it there that was, you know, discovered. I think I've heard that it was the largest 35 millimeter film shoot in Australian history to date. And so, you know, there's just been so much to work on. And you know, that's film preservation and digitization is not it's takes a lot of resources to do that. So we've been, you know, going at it in chunks and doing our best to get through it all.
I mean, I'm going back against the line you just said, but might something like that get a center showing one day when you're done, that the restored, I know you guys are a world away from releasing it. That's not your world at all, but within the confines of the Dylan Center, after all that work, is there a chance? I'm not asking you to commit to something, but is that the kind of thing that someone would consider saying, hey, we're going to play an hour or two from the Australian stuff we just spent a year working on?
I mean, everything that we've done in the center has been really in conjunction with our partners, you know, Dylan's office and Sony and Universal, and it would be fantastic to be able to do those sorts of things. And we do have some ideas, you know, down the line for a few things. It we'll just have to wait and see.
So even at the Dylan Center, the stuff you show in the theater, those folks are involved in saying, hey, that's okay to put that out.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely the you know, they hold the copyright to all of those materials. So yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what I'm learning and just clarifying is even within the four walls, that applies the public side of the four walls, as opposed to, you know, a DVD release, which would obviously be a whole different thing.
Yes, yes, yeah. We, you know, as museums and, you know, nonprofit educational facilities, we're still, you know, beholden to all of those laws around copyright and licensing and permissions and the like.
The other one I have to mention, that you guys, it was encouraging to me to see you in or interesting and positive to see you drawing from those what you call the No Direction Home interviews that the fans have known for a long time, that that set of interviews got done with Dylan and with many other people for a number of years. I don't see it show up on too many Holy Grail lists, but it's on my Holy Grail list of that set of interviews. Both Dylan and everyone else, just in totality, must be, you know, ungodly amazing. I mean, and so I'm glad you're, you know, we get a big chunk of them in the book, or at least references from them. And to know, at least for me, it gives me, as long as you guys have them and they're well and there's hope that one day we'll continue to benefit from them or hear them.
Yeah, I want to pause on that for a second because, you know, the work that, you know, Scorsese and Dylan's office and Columbia, all of these folks have been doing the idea of a Dylan archive and you know, the materials that, you know, sort of naturally generate out of the projects that to create an archive. It's incredibly important. It's Biograph was huge. The Bootleg series has been huge. No Direction Home, you know, all of that work was really, it seems to me that stuff was being pulled together. Oral histories were being done, getting at people while they were still alive. I mean, it's just incredibly important.
Yeah. And those, I don't know if those started even before 2000, but it felt like there was 10 years of those interviews or, you know, there was a long, and I had heard about, you know, this guy got called or someone knew this one was taking place. So I think what you're saying that the office did it, we all know, an incredible job of stewardship and of creation and protection of those things. But that interview series in particular just seems really, really foundational.
I just wanted to piggyback off Mark's point about sort of it being sort of a collective, you know, who's been stewarding and prior to the creation of the archive and the center. But I think, you know, when we were drawing things for the book, we were drawing from the archive, but the archive does have gaps, you know, where there were certain things where we needed particular pieces. And so I just wanted to like say that, you know, there's this community of people who have been collecting Bob Dylan long before there was a Bob Dylan archive in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that some of their collections have found their way into the permanent collections of the Bob Dylan Center, like the Mitch Blank collection and the Bill Pagel collection, which form a substantive set of like really amazing and new material in this book. For instance, Bill Pagel had a lot of great material related to Dylan's youth in Minnesota. And Mitch Blank helped us to acquire the Cynthia Gooding collection, which has this really amazing, her notes on seeing Dylan at Gertie's Folk City, you know, on the back of a Gertie's Folk City flyer. So there's them. And then there's this other, you know, sort of just friends of the archive, people like Barry Ullman or Jeff Gold or Odd-Bjørn Sultnes, who provided us, you know, an incredible sort of opened up their own personal collections in a really generous way. And I think, we all owe them, you know, a debt for those pieces that are in there.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you said it. Well, Mitch is a friend, and I know what, and I got to know Barry at the event earlier this year, and I know how much those guys have done for all of us. And so I'm glad you called that out. And so Mark knows this. My own little piece of infamy is that I handed Mark a pair of the Tempest coins, and I was literally jumping up and down when I saw them in the book. So I know everybody who has cool Dylan things now thinks they belong at the archive, and I hope everyone will keep sending them your way because you make great use of them. Anyway, guys, look, the book is unbelievable. I'm glad to be able to say it again and again. I think the Dylan community is going to embrace this, you know, and not just the hardcores, but you really give, you know, that middle tier, you know, swimmers, I guess, you know, the ability to grab something they know and just keep going or go deeper. The threads in this thing are really worth pulling. I really do think there's a book on each page or a big set of stories and all the things surrounding it. And I'm actually hoping there's ways that people can, I think there will be ways people leverage off of this. You know, it's just an incredible resource. A book as big as Bob Dylan, which is a hell of a thing to try to do. So thank you for all that hard work, the years of it, and for putting this out. And it's amazing. And what you do in the archive every day, you know, as you know, you got a lot of supporters cheering for you guys out here who appreciate what you guys do. But to have this take home version is really incredible. So thanks for everything.
Yeah, no, thank you, Craig. And I want to say one last thing. The book has allowed us to, we've got exhibitions for, you know, decades to come that we'll have at the Bob Dylan Center, the first of which is going to be a big exhibition on the book. But this has been helpful for us to, you know, put together those future exhibitions, whether it's Bob Dylan in 63 and 64 and sort of what was going on then. You know, there's a ton of material around Rolling Thunder. So we're really excited for people to see this, go, gosh, I want to see the real thing, and then come out to Tulsa and check it out. It's something that has to be seen in person.
One of the themes that we hit on the book is Dylan closes his Nobel lecture, which is that it's not about the printed words on the page. Those are nice and they serve a purpose, but you know, his work, his music comes alive on record and in person. And in person, you can still go see Bob Dylan, thank goodness. But that there's this whole multimedia dimension. And that is something that really, you know, the book is incredible. It's amazing, but it shouldn't be a substitute, you know, for a trip to the Bob Dylan Center. I think that regardless, like the book, regardless of your knowledge or interest, you'll find something there to enlighten you or inspire you and to come away with like a real appreciation for the, you know, the artistry of Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I agree. That's what it'll do. I've said it before. I spent 4 days there and skipped things. The museum is just incredible. I will say once again, this diving through this, through the half the book I got through, the enormity of this guy, which I've been in awe of for a long time. So someone in there makes the quote, I forget who it was, maybe Lee Ranaldo, one of the musicians, that they read that Dylan was the most documented person in history. And they weren't saying it like it was a fact, but they had heard, you know, Jesus was the second possible contender. Thought that immediately occurred to me is there's that much on him and we all feel like it isn't enough. It's not quite nailed down. There's all these places we want to dive more on, which is just staggering that something like this can be come out and it's like, oh, I want the other 300 volumes, or I want to go to Tulsa and spend 4 more days, you know, diving in person. So all a testament to Mr. Dylan, a huge help to all of us who care about it, though, that you guys have built. So thank you very much again for putting it out.
Thanks for listening.